better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough, or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, August the 1st, 2024, and this is episode 3534 of the Survival Podcast. Couldn't end the week on a 3535. I just like those repetitive numbers, but it's not to be. We'll have that show together on Monday, and tomorrow we will have a Friday flashback. Today, of course, though, is an expert counsel Q&A show, and I've got a good lineup. Some folks you haven't heard of heard from in a while, like Joel Riles and Dr. Barry. Brand new person who you have heard from before, but not as an expert counsel member, called this an audition, Jesse Markowitz. Really switched on tech guy. He's going to be kind of our tech expert if everything works out. Here's what we got today. World War III and what does Trump really believe? And that might be an important question to answer from Chris Rossini and Dr. Paul. On some levels, I think everybody's kind of, since Trump had the assassination attempt on him, assumed that Trump was going to be president. I certainly figured it was going to happen. And then Joe, you know, finally admitted he doesn't know what the hell's going on and dropped out. And now we have Kamala. And Kamala is, she's a horrible candidate. She's a terrible candidate. But I don't think we need to be coming at this from, it's going to be Trump. I think we have to come at this point from, it could be either one of them. I think it's a coin toss. I think if America votes on issues, it's Trump. And Trump wins, period. If America votes on emotion, that means behaving stupidly, then you will pick the dumber of the two stupid candidates, and that would be Kamala. So, but we'll hear what Dr. Paul and Chris have to say about Trump's beliefs and what may or may not happen as far as World War freaking III, which would be better if it just didn't, huh? You know, I grew up in the 70s and 80s. I had enough of this shit back then. I thought we had gotten past the idea of, like, you know, nuclear irradiating the entire planet. So let's get on something better. Dr. Ken Berry will follow up with a question that I actually hit on last week, or a week before, I guess. An individual who's having problems losing weight. They recently were pregnant. They're breastfeeding now, and they're having trouble losing weight. And Ken has some additions there, and I agree with his additions. John Pugliano and Sean Mills will both be answering the same question back to back, kind of like we did last week where we got answers from Ben Falk, Nick Ferguson, and then me on the same question. We got two answers on this about off-grid communications for those that do not want, for whatever reason, to obtain a ham license. Jesse Markowitz will be talking about password security rules to keep your accounts and data safe. Nicole Sauce will follow up to that question that me and Ben and Nick did last week on starting up your brand new property for a food-producing homestead. And she phrases it a lot different than mine, but it's very similar to the answer I gave with some unique Nicole insights to it. I think that's cool. Joel Riles will talk about training multiple dogs so they don't get confused as to who's being asked to do what. I'm sure you've had this. Sit, and the dog you want to sit looks at you like, I ain't sitting, and the other dog sits down. That's not that big of a deal, but when you are doing things like come and stay, and you want one dog here and one dog there, it can be a problem. And Joel, his training is really advanced, and they do a lot of things like have other dogs playing while one dog has to sit still. Dogs walking over each other, rattling shit around, they have to ignore it. So he'll talk about how we can get those dogs telefocused in on what we want this dog to do versus what we want that dog to do. And I'm going to talk about something that I was talking about recently. People like Uber Eats drivers and stuff. I was talking about, you know, preserving and building wealth and adapting to the new economy. And I said one of the beautiful things about being an Uber driver is that you don't make any money on paper. And I got an email from someone named Christine, and she wants to know what I mean by that, because she's thinking about taking a contract job. It pays $18 an hour, but she has to do her own taxes and how that would apply there. And she doesn't really follow what I meant by this. And I'll tell you why Christine's position may not be as advantageous as an Uber driver from a tax deferral strategy, but it might be able to be, but it's going to require, you know, and I'll say, a tax attorney, CPA, and in this case, probably just a good CPA. Probably a five-minute conversation with a good CPA. Is there any way I can structure this? So we'll talk about that. But what I really want to get to the heart of is the idea of not making money on paper, what that actually means, and why it's a good thing. How that is the way that you focus on the 95% of the tax code that tells you how not to do what 5% of the tax code tells you you have to do. So that will be my segment today. Before we get started, let's remind you guys of a way you can help support this show. So we do a lot of stuff that you can participate in to help us out, and I try to do it in a way that benefits everybody. And one of those is I do product reviews. And I figure most people that buy a product from a product review eventually would have bought something like it anyway. Or they're buying it because it goes into something in their life. And buying through my link is just taking an extra 5 seconds. So it doesn't cost extra money. And I do these reviews on Amazon and with this new company I've been working with since about March called Vivor. And I decided that I would maybe do things a little bit differently with Vivor going forward in some instances like today. So I have a great rep at Vivor. She'll pretty much send me just about anything I ask for, but I don't want to abuse that relationship and be asking for shit just to get shit or to be acquiring things I really don't need that may be hard to get away. And I don't need any more tables around here, if you feel me. I've got a huge outdoor kitchen, lots of counter space. I mean, gobs of counter space. We don't really need any tables or work surfaces at the moment anyway. I would certainly utilize what I'm going to talk about today if they did. So I haven't actually put my hands on the equipment that I'm going to tell you about today from Vivor. I don't think that I need to because I'm pretty sure that a stainless steel table only has to be a stainless steel table, and it's pretty hard to mess that up. And I've checked out a lot of reviews on them on YouTube from others, and I even linked to a few of them in my write-up today. And I actually didn't go out and say, hey, let me go find something to do this with as I was researching other Vivor product, because I do a lot of pre-investigation before I even reach out to my rep and say, hey, can you send me this thing? Because Vivor makes some fantastic stuff, and they make some crappy shit, too. I mean, just to be honest, like, the catalog is so broad and so many different things. And you know, they're based in China, and they're basically making product that lots of other people are putting their names on, too. And so you're going to get some that's not the best. And so I try to only pick the stuff that's well thought of, has good reviews, etc. But again, a stainless steel work surface table is not something that you can really mess up unless you really, really messed it up. And so I checked out all these reviews and all, and they all come out good. And what I have is a write-up today that has a whole list of items. One of them is actually a medical cart. Like for a dentist office or a doctor's office, it's got a drawer, a bottom shelf, a top shelf. It's got side guards and a back guard so stuff doesn't roll off of it. It's kind of small, but it would make a really cool, like, miniature movable island for you apartment people or folks with really small houses and things like that that just need to be able to have a place to work from in addition to the limited counter space you have. It also would make kind of a cool little outdoor grilling table. Depending on what you want. The nice thing about that one, it has a drawer with it. Then I have a couple tables that are really big, heavy-duty in the write-up. These are like restaurant-quality, you know, what you would see prep cooks working on in the back of a kitchen. And these are fantastic. The thing is, they are on clearance right now, these two of them. Very adjustable, very heavy-duty. They're large. One's about 5 foot long. The other one's about 4 foot long. And about 34 inches high, so a perfect working height for those kitchen applications. And they don't come with wheels, but, you know, you can put the type of stuff that these things are built with, they all can have casters added if you choose to. Vivor just doesn't offer them that way. You would have to acquire them somehow. Then there's a table cart that is a lot like that medical cart, but it's better dimensioned for, like, an outdoor grill or kitchen island, but doesn't have the drawer. Then there's like a dedicated outdoor grill cart that is made for outdoor grilling. That's in limited supply. They have 50 of the stainless steel top ones or 50 of the black top ones and 25 of the stainless steel ones when I put them out. They're 34 inches high, nice work height. They've got hooks to hang utensils from, a bottom shelf, a top shelf, wheels on one side, handle on the other so you can move it around. There's just a ton of stuff that they have in this wheelhouse. And so I have also put links in the write-up to, like, the whole product line. But if you have, if you're ever someplace in your home and you're like, I wish there was a place to put shit here, and a table or a workstation would do well for you, check this stuff out. Stainless steel pretty much lasts forever. It doesn't rust. It's easy to completely clean. It's clean. That's why I choose for food prep surfaces and all. So I'm not going to do a ton of these reviews with Lavoir product that I don't review. But if I see something and I can verify that it's quality, and it's something I don't need and I don't want to take advantage of my relationship and ask for product that I don't really need or want around here, and I can comfortably recommend it, I will. You know, recently I did the rain barrel. Now, that was like, I don't know about this. There's a lot that can go wrong with water and fittings and shit. So I had to have one of those, even though I didn't need one. This, I'm totally comfortable recommending these. So check them out again. The stainless steel work tables, carts, stuff like that from Vore. Awesome stuff and really, really affordable. You know, price it out against other product that's similar to it, and you'll see what I mean. With that, let's go ahead and hear from Dr. Paul and Chris Rossini on the potential for World War III and what the hell does Orange Man really believe.
We went from years of COVID tyranny, perhaps the biggest crime in the history of the world those years, from years of that seamlessly, we transitioned to this Ukraine conflict. And all of a sudden, all the COVID went, under the rug. All the perpetrators that were on television, we know who all they are, they scattered into the shadows, never to be seen again. They were on TV telling you how you're going to die if you don't obey them, and then they're just gone. And then everything was replaced with Ukraine flags. There were Ukraine flags everywhere you looked on Twitter. People were putting them next to their names. I remember going to the airport, and the airport had big signs saying that we stand with Ukraine. They were selling T-shirts. And now here we are. Hundreds of billions of dollars have been siphoned away that we could have used in our country. They're gone. Ukraine lost, you know, they really suffered the brunt of it. We took a financial hit, but they lost 500,000 people. Their country has been destroyed. And now, you know, it's the writing is on the wall. Trump, I saw him with Vance doing a interview, and he says, yeah, he goes, Russia beat Hitler. He said, Russia beat Napoleon. Yeah, he's stating the obvious. There was no chance, you know, for Ukraine. But look at the lies. We went from COVID lies to Ukraine has to beat Putin because he's going to conquer all of Europe. All of it was a lie, too. There was no chance. And now the reality is coming. And now we're starting to see narrative shifts again. Now it's we're shifting from Putin to everything is Iran. Iran here, Iran, Iran, Iran. And they're just seeding. They're planting the seeds in everyone's mind for what? Another war with Iran, which is by proxy Russia and China. They're not going to let Iran go up in flames. So we are very concerned about this narrative shift because this is how they sweep Ukraine under the rug by putting your attention on Iran, and this is very dangerous. And we better hope, you know, assuming he wins, that President Trump does not want this. I don't think he wants war with Russia and China. That's just my thought. I don't know him. Only he knows what's in his mind and in his heart. And a war with Iran would bring that. So we better hope that President Trump does not want war with Iran. Our country is nothing like it was back in World War II when we were victorious. All of the advantages are gone. We had all the gold at that time. Today, Russia and China are up to their eyeballs in gold. We manufacture nothing. China manufactures everything. We were an actual creditor nation. We were the creditor of the world. And today we are $35 trillion in debt. And we had the dollar reserve, and country after country are ditching the dollar. They're going with their local currencies, trading with Russia and China in their own currencies. We are in zero position to get into any type of world war. We need to rebuild what has been destroyed in this country. And, you know, when you looked at Congress the other day, when they gave all those standing ovations, I read that they gave more standing ovations to Netanyahu than Kim Jong-un receives in his own country. That's how many they gave him. Now, there were no U.S. troops sent to Ukraine, thank God. Despite all the devastation, I feel so bad for the Ukrainians. American troops were not sent there. But if we're called to get into a war with Iran for Israel, do you think our Congress is going to say no to a draft or to sending troops to that war? You better think about it hard and look at how they are. Do you think they would send Americans for Israel out there? It's very possible. This is a great danger that we are facing, and it all really hinges, again, assuming that he wins, on where Trump's mind and where his heart lies.
Very good, Chris, and I hope our viewers take note of your warning because it's very very appropriate. You know, the whole idea of America first is very, very attractive because in our early history, we were looked up to because it was unique and it was different. And our Constitution was very unique and different. And I think America first is in the presentation and examples and setting the standards for what a free society ought to be. It was never perfect. The Constitution is not perfect, but it did represent a serious and significant improvement on the thinking of what government should be like. And if we thought more in promoting becoming first in the world, America first, in the presentation of liberty, it would be a lot different because we have to refute the people that come along, a bunch of isolationists, and yet I see non-intervention as the opposite of isolation, because you're friends with people, you trade with people, you don't cheat people with a bad monetary system, you don't use force to take countries and pretend that we can protect everybody. So it's quite a bit different, and the definition of American first and their intent is very important, but the many who still believe in it and the origination of it was mainly motivated to promote the goodness of America, and I think that's a pretty good idea.
So sitting here listening to that, and as I'm listening to Dr. Paul's part at the end, I was thinking, you know, I really think this isn't going to be a Trump decision. I think this is going to be a war that may be very well started before the month of August is over, and certainly before the election, so the Democrats can hold it up as, you have to keep us so we can win the war. And I thought, am I being a little bit over the top? So I'm sitting here listening to this, and on my other machine, I pull up X. And I haven't confirmed this yet, but it's based on the person that posted it. It's probably valid. Breaking. Senator Lindsey Graham has introduced a resolution to authorize the use of U.S. armed forces against Iran. Lindsey Graham, Republican. Yeah. Chicken hawk, piece of human shit. There, I said it. That's what I think of that man. He is a chicken hawk, piece of shit. This is the guy that's been for every single piece of legislation that's taken rights from the American people. The Patriot Act, he was all about the Patriot Act. The Freedom Act, all about the Freedom Act. And they took way more rights from Americans than they empowered our government to do things about foreign actors. NDAA, he's always 100% behind it. Doesn't matter what's in the new one, he's always for it. He's a piece of garbage. And you notice they get a Republican to do it. They get a Republican to do it. It wasn't hard. Tell Lindsey Graham you want to bomb something. He's for it. What is it? It doesn't matter. Lindsey's for it. Lindsey Graham is outstretched in being a chicken hawk by only one name comes to my mind. John Bolton. Lindsey Graham would bomb a fucking island that the Boy Scouts ran. John Bolton would bomb one the fucking Girl Scouts ran. That's what I'm going to say about that. Let's move on and talk about something else before I freaking start having my mind blow up here today. Let's hear from Dr. Barry on losing weight for a woman who's recently had a baby and is breastfeeding and using keto and not getting the results she wants.
Hello, TSP crew. This is Dr. Ken Barry today answering a question from Jessica in Maine. She has two questions. Why am I not losing weight on keto? And does breastfeeding slow down weight loss on keto? I'm a 42-year-old breastfeeding woman who started keto a month and a half ago. I lost 11 pounds on my first 3 weeks, but haven't lost an ounce since. I'm very strict with my diet and don't do dirty keto. I only eat whole foods, non-starchy, and meat. Keep my carbs under 25 grams a day. calories under 1500 and fat under 75 grams. So first of all, stop keeping your fat under a certain number. I want you to eat more fat, not less fat. I need to lose 75 pounds to be a healthy weight for my height, so I have plenty to lose. So first of all, when you're breastfeeding, that tends to help women lose weight. Not always, but often. Stop counting calories. Stop limiting your fat intake. Very, very commonly, women will keep fat under a certain grams per day. And if you're underfeeding your body, you're basically convincing your body that you're in a famine situation. Your body's going to lower your metabolic rate and keep you from losing fat, which is really what you want to lose. Bump up your fat intake. Eat until you're comfortably stuffed. Stop limiting calories, stop limiting food, and definitely stop limiting your fat intake. After about a month of that, when you're eating healthy animal fat and protein until you're completely satiated, meaning you're comfortably stuffed, eat two times a day or three times a day since you're breastfeeding. Stop under eating. That is actually slowing down your weight loss. Hope this helps. This is Dr. Barry. Talk to you guys next time.
So I largely agree with that. Now, Ken and I have a difference opinion on calories. Ken says calories don't count, and I say bullshit, and Ken says there's studies that prove I'm wrong, and Ken and I have been talking about this for 8 years, and he said there's studies, and he says he's going to send them to me, and hey, no studies ever come. Ever, Ken. Never. Not once. Not once. You've never shown me a single study that's shown that a person can eat unlimited calories and still lose weight. It doesn't mean I disagree with the premise here. It is very possible to send your body into a very low metabolic rate by under-eating. What I've always said about calories is if you're eating as much as you want and you're not getting any results with keto, then cut your calories. I've also said if you're not getting results, you could also try going full on carnivore. I've also said if you're not getting results, do a one-day or a two-day fast, right? Or reduce your window of your eating from something like if you're doing like a 14-10, go to a 16-12 or an 18-6 or something like that. Basically, what I'm saying is do something different. I think in this instance, when you're producing product for a child, a very rich product, by the way, breast milk is a very high calorie product. Your body probably is in a conservation mode, afraid that you're going to starve to death because you're not getting enough food. I also agree with Ken that your fat is probably being limited too much. What you should be eating is as much fat as you can handle, and that's going to limit your protein by itself, right? And I would still say, as I said when I talked about this one, it's very possible that simply going full carnivore and leaving the keto behind altogether would be a way to go. And when you say 25 carbs, I don't know if you mean net or total. And that does matter, especially depending on where you're getting your carbs from. Now, the thing is, since you're doing what you call a clean keto and the way it sounds like you're doing it, that probably doesn't matter. That probably does not matter. But, you know, as Ken says, you can trust broccoli. You can't trust low-carb tortillas. That's a big lie. That's just a big freaking lie. Anyway, hopefully that helps you. Let's move on and hear now from... You're going to be two in a row. It's the same question. It's about off-grid communications in a situation when the person doesn't want to get a ham license for whatever reason. Let's hear first from John Pugliano, and then following up with that, Sean Mills.
Hello, TSP. Well, today I'll take a break from answering investing questions, and instead I'm going to talk about emergency communication. Today we have a question from Emily, and she says, "My husband and I live in the city of Austin, Texas, and we want to have a backup plan for communicating with our family, most of whom live within a 20-mile radius of us, including our two sets of aging parents." And when she talks about emergency communication, she's assuming that power and internet and cell phone service are out and the roads are blocked. So what would be her best option to communicate with her family during an emergency? Okay, so you guys know that I am enthusiastic and passionate about ham radio. And in this particular case, I do think that the hands-down best solution for a communication system that's totally off-grid and doesn't rely on centralized networks or repeater systems or anything other than simple point-to-point simplex communication. I think by far that is amateur radio in this particular situation. With a 20-mile radius around Austin, it would probably be best served in the 40-meter band. That's in the range of 700 megahertz. You could do that with off-the-shelf technology. In fact, it could be done very inexpensively using older equipment that's even, 10, 20, 30 years old. The equipment is fairly low power. It could be easily run off of 12-volt DC current, which could easily be supplied with a small battery pack and charged either through solar panels or a small generator. And since we're dealing with around a 20-mile radius, a complicated antenna system wouldn't be needed. In fact, you'd be relying on ground waves and near-vertical incident sky waves. And so a very simple wire antenna, maybe 65 feet long, no more than 5 feet or so above the ground, could accomplish all this. But there's one big problem that makes amateur radio out of the reach of most people, and it has nothing to do with having to pass a test or get approval through the FCC. It just comes down to the fact that these systems, although they're simple and robust and fairly low technology, the problem is they require skill and knowledge to operate them. They're not simply plug-and-play consumer-type products. And so while I do think that the situation you're describing is a textbook example of a use for ham radio, I wouldn't recommend it to you because I don't think you have the interest or the inclination to put the system together. Nor would I recommend any of the other radio type services like Citizens Band, Family Radio Service, or GMRS. They're just not going to be able to provide you with reliable coverage over the 20 plus miles that you're going to need. But something that would work in a grid down situation for basic communication that isn't overly expensive and doesn't require a great deal of training or ability to use would be a satellite text messaging device. The device is going to cost you around $300, and then of course you'll have to have a data plan with that. By the time you add in all the junk fees, and even if you go with the lowest level of coverage, you're still probably looking at $150 to $200 a year. So that could add up pretty quickly. But overall, it's a very low price to pay for emergency communication during a disaster. So what I'd recommend is you look at a company like Garmin and their two-way messaging devices, get a set of the InReach Messenger, try it out, see how it works for you, show it to your elderly parents, get a feel for how comfortable they would be using something like that, and then if you think that's a solution that's going to work for you, you can slowly add in and buy more devices and create your own very resilient emergency communication network. Well, Emily, thanks for your question. Next time I'll be back with more on investing and finance. Until then, you can catch me at Investable Wealth or the Wealth Studying Podcast.
Hey, everybody. It's Sean Mills with Hack My Homestead. And today I have a combo that I'm attacking with Mr. John Pugliano that can provide Emily. So, Emily, I'm going to go through these one by one. Landline is not a great idea. In most places, especially big cities, they don't even have the copper on the poles anymore, so you can't even get a landline. And even if they do, obviously, if you're in a storm that's bad enough where cell phone communications and internet communications and roads were impassable, I don't think that your telephone lines would be up. Starlink is a good option. Satellite phone is a good option. Satellite phone is going to be much cheaper than Starlink on an annual basis, but it's not going to be what I would call cheap, especially for something that's only like a once per so many years use. So I personally have Starlink. I love it. Starlink does have 6 downlink facilities in the United States. So theoretically, if one or more of those 6 facilities were taken out for whatever reason, then the Starlink would not work as well. So that's something else to think about. The satellites might work, but they still need that downlink in order for the internet to actually work. So that kind of takes Starlink out, I think. And the other thing is it's significantly more expensive than regular internet in most places. And so for you and all of your family to switch over to that, that'd be a pretty big deal. Sounds like they're probably not interested in that. Number three was walkie-talkies. No, there's no walkie-talkies that are going to give you a 20-mile radius. And then ham, yes. Not only would you have to get the ham license, but everyone else that's going to have one of those radios would have to get it. That, in my opinion, is probably the best option in terms of actually communicating in a scenario that, like you've described. But I understand, you know, not wanting to be licensed and not wanting to go through all of the rigmarole of getting set up as a ham. Here's the reality. It's not just buying a radio. Like, there's a lot that goes into it. So you and your parents and your significant other's parents and whatever other family members are in the area, everyone's got to become proficient at amateur radio and whichever radios you guys go with in order for that to work. So those are some things to think about. Given everything that you mentioned, I would probably go satellite phone. Personally, I would probably go Starlink, but with your specific situation, I would go with the satellite phone because it will work just like a cell phone for texting, and it's not hard to use. There's a very, very low barrier to entry, and those also, the other nice thing there is you can power them with a power bank. They have way better battery life than an actual cell phone, and you could even get a small solar panel and hook it right up to the phone that has the battery on it. So that's the direction I would go. You know, the other side of that coin is that everyone needs to understand that if the roads aren't working and the comms are all down, the best thing to do is to stay in place. And so those aging parents need to be prepared to do that as well without you calling and checking on them. I know it makes us feel better when we can call and check on our significant others, but in a scenario like you described where you can't get there, there's no internet, there's no cell service, the reality is that they need to be in a situation where they can handle themselves for, you know, a week, maybe longer. I mean, we saw with Hurricane Beryl here, 2.7 million households lost power, and I was thinking about something. Obviously, it's miserable enough in Houston with the heat and the humidity and then not having, you know, air conditioning for a week or sometimes 2 weeks, I heard. But imagine all of the food waste, right? So obviously food is more expensive than it's been in a long time, maybe ever. And, you know, you figure the whole fridge, the whole freezer, now's the time to get your backup power in place. I've been saying for years that the grid is going to become less and less reliable as it continues to age and we put more load on it at the same time. We take away things like coal power, which does a really good job at handling baseload, and we add things like solar and wind, which are intermittent and have to be paired with both batteries and or literally taking more reliable forms of energy production off the grid so that there's a space for them to operate. The only way you can operate in that type of environment is to have your own battery backup, have a generator, have some gas, small solar array. You know, for $5,000, you can get a solar array, an inverter, and a battery or two, and at least that keeps you going during the day. It keeps your food safe. I literally just got back from Florida where I built a battery box basically for a family member because he loses power when there's hurricanes that go through Florida. And he's like, look, I can deal with whatever, but I don't want to lose all my food that I've got in the fridge and I've got in the freezer. And so we literally spent 2 days and he spent about $3,000 altogether for battery, inverter, the box, all of the wiring, solar panels to put up on his roof. And now he's just got a little bit of backup. It's not going to do a ton, but it means he doesn't have to run his generator through the night. He can run his generator in the evening and power up the devices while charging the battery. And then he can use the battery power overnight. And then the next morning, he's probably going to have to go out and crank the generator back up. But if you don't have something like that, you really need to think about getting it. Because even if you're in a place where you don't have a ton of power outages, they're going to become longer or if you don't have them, that you're going to start having them. That's just the state of the grid that we're in right now. All right, guys, I went a little bit long today, but I actually wanted to read all of Emily's questions and answer them one by one to pair with John's response as well. Thanks, and have a great one.
So I'm going to say a few additions here. One, I think we over concern ourselves with this idea that all the communications, all everything's going to be down everywhere for some extended period of time. It certainly can happen, and backup comms are useful, but we don't all need to go to this extreme of concern that it seems like might be here. Number two, there are certain people who should not get a ham license. One, I think, is actually the people here. Like, it doesn't matter that you, like John was saying, you can pass a test and all. It's not that hard, right? It just, you need everybody using it to know how to use it, and that's the problem in this scenario. But there's a lot of people we hear from, they don't want a ham license because I don't want the government to know who I am. Look, I'll tell you the people that can not get a ham license for that reason. If you were born and never got a Social Security number, you're currently unknown to the government and you want to stay that way. Or you are a felon on the run from the law. Otherwise, this is the dumbest thing, and it has nothing to do with the person asking the question. It's for some of y'all other people. This is the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life. You have a Social Security card, a driver's license, right? You probably pay your taxes, etc. You have all these ways the government knows who you are and where you are, but because they know you have a ham license, they're going to send black helicopters to your house. If you're that person, and the person writing this email and asking this question is not, but if you're that person, stop it. Stop it, stop it, stop it, stop it. You're the same person telling me that you need no KYC Bitcoin because the government knows you have Bitcoin, and you pay 95% of your bills with a fucking Visa card. Stop it. Just stop it. I will say that with the right equipment, CB could be quite useful here, even though both of them kind of pushed you away from that, in that you don't necessarily need to communicate 20 miles. You need to be able to communicate across 20 miles, and you have repeaters, whether you know it or not. They're the people in the network. So if you can teach people, turn this on, okay? Turn this on. Put it on, and just preset the channel that you're going to put them on. And if you get something like single sideband, you'll extend your range, and you can go ahead and you can pay somebody to increase your power in your CB past those four measly watts up to like 50, okay? And you know what? No one will ever, ever, ever care. This is something I've always been dumbfounded. It's always the ham guys that think it's that somebody's going to care. All right, that you're pushing more power on a CB. There's literally truck stops all across the country whenever you drive that advertise the service of boosting your CB. Okay, just don't get on the 19. That's the trucker channel. When we ran CBs for a while to play with them, there wasn't nobody anywhere except channel 19. And if you got off on a single sideband somewhere, you could forget about it. So if you could teach them enough, turn it on and use it properly. And one can tell the other what the next one said, then you can play the telephone game that way, and Bill can tell Tammy, and Tammy can tell you. So that might work. I don't know. But the beauty of CB is it goes in a car, and it runs off a car battery, and you have an off-grid system for your car. It's called the motor in the alternator. So I wouldn't write that off, but I would look at it and see, where is everybody? Where is everybody? And is there a, like, so it's a 20-mile radius, but if it's a 20-mile radius from you, you only have to be able to reach 10 miles, right? Right? Or is it, no, that's be a diameter. So if it's, you got to really look at what your layout is here. Get a map and put marks where, because she said radius, okay. If it was a 20-mile diameter, but a lot of times people do that. They'll say a 20-mile radius, but they don't really mean it. They really mean a 20-mile circle. That's diameter. And if you're in the middle of that circle, you're only reaching 10 miles out to each edge. And if there's anybody in between, you've got a repeater, a human being that can act as a repeater. So that's just something to think about. I'm not saying it'll work. I'm saying look at it. Get a map out. You know, print a map out of the area from Google Maps and put a dot where everybody's house is. And then remember, you know, radio is line of sight, not road, not line of road. So how far are you really from these people? That would be something else to look at. Just some thoughts there. But the rest of y'all, don't be afraid of a damn ham license if it'll do you good to have one. If you don't want one, that's fine. And if you don't need one, that's fine. But if you want the capability, don't be afraid of the damn piece of paper. It doesn't matter. The government already knows who you are and where you are, and they can find you anytime they want to. Anyway, moving on, let's hear about password security from Jesse Markowitz.
This is Jesse Markowitz from YourPersonalBitcoinAssistant.com. Today, I have a question about passwords. The question was simple. How long should my password be? The quick answer is, if you create passwords with a random combination using uppercase and lowercase letters, numbers, and special characters, 12 characters long is long enough for most everyone. Another approach, with systems that allow for much longer passwords, is to use a number of truly randomly selected words. Bitcoin seed phrases use 12 or 24 words. You can use the same type of approach with fewer words, but from a larger list. To get a similar level of password strength, you'll need 4 or more words and much more than 12 characters long. It's easier to remember, but harder to ensure randomness and more to type. Well, with this question answered, I thought it'd be useful for us to discuss a little bit more about passwords. They protect so much, and most people give them very little thought. What actions you need to take are going to depend upon your threat level. My focus today, and most days, is just regular folks. If you're a potential target with a very large, publicly known wealth or other elevated risks, you should plan on being more careful and doing more to protect yourself and your accounts. And, of course, protecting your Little League calendar is much less critical than your bank account. Now, no matter how strong your password is, if you give it away, it does you no good. So you need to always be careful when entering your password that the website or application you're entering it into is actually the correct one. There's a number of email phishing schemes, social engineering, big websites, fake websites, a number of different ways that people may be trying to get your information from you. Be careful and protect yourself. Also, even if you never mess up, it's also possible that the site that you're accessing might have a breach on their side and your ID and password may get leaked. This is why it's crucial that you do not reuse passwords. If a criminal has your password for one site, they will then try that same password on a large number of other sites, banks, brokerages, email accounts, anything else that might be a higher value target where they think you might have an account. You do not want one failure to result in more failures as they get into more and more accounts of yours. Now, most of us do have a lot of accounts these days, email, social media websites, streaming services, financial accounts, calendar apps, many, many more. Having a long, random, unique password for each is safe, but you also have to be able to remember these and enter these passwords every time you need access. How do you keep track of all of these? You need a password manager. A password manager will store your user ID and password for each of these different places and make it easy to find the right user ID and password when you're trying to connect in. As part of that, they also make it easier for you to copy and paste so you don't have to risk mistyping a long, complex password. Click here, click there, boom, and you're ready to go. As a bonus, almost all password managers today will suggest secure random passwords for you. So when you're creating a new password, you don't have to worry about if it's secure or not. Password managers will also encrypt all of your passwords to prevent anyone else from being able to access them. So all you need to do is remember the one master password for your password manager. Which password manager should you use? There's a number of free and paid products out there that you can use. In addition, your browser and your mobile device likely already have a password manager built in. I use Firefox. It's got a password manager built in. I have an iPhone. It's got a password manager built in. Most of the others do as well. You can do some research, find a password manager that you like, and use that. The reality of it is, any password manager is going to do a far better job than storing your passwords on a spreadsheet, post-it notes, or anything along those lines. Personally, I use a product called Vault Warden that I self-host on my StartOS server. You should pick what works for you. Next, for important accounts, you should take advantage of enabling two-factor authentication whenever possible. This is when, in addition to your password, there's a second authentication required to gain access into the account. Generally, it's something like a random number that they send you via text message to your cell phone or sometimes your email account. There are also authenticator apps that you can use instead. These programs run on your phone or on your computer and do the same thing, generate a number that you type in as a secondary authentication. By using an authenticator app, you can protect yourself from what's called a SIM swapping attack, where someone has your text messages routed to their phone, not yours. SIM-swapping attacks aren't particularly common, but they do happen. It's something you should be aware of and be careful about. Two-factor authentication gives you an extra level of protection and is well worth it. One last piece of advice. As important as it is to protect your passwords from bad people, you also want to make sure that you have a plan in place in case something happens to your password manager or to you. So if your password manager runs locally on your device, consider an encrypted cloud backup. If the password manager runs on the cloud, consider a local backup. Also, give some thought as to what you would do if you were to ever forget your master password or if something were to happen to you. Is there a copy of the master password hidden somewhere or with a trusted person? Do you have a plan in place, a system that allows you to recover in cases like this? In summary, use strong passwords. Make sure when you're entering passwords, you're in the correct website or application. Do not reuse your passwords. Use a password manager to protect your passwords. Use two-factor authentication for important accounts whenever possible. And make sure your passwords are backed up and you have a plan in place in case something happens. This has been Jesse Markowitz from YourPersonalBitcoinAssistant.com. I hope this has been helpful for you. I love learning and teaching about technology, particularly Bitcoin, Lightning, self-hosting software, privacy, and other technology issues. Send questions into Jack, and I'll get them answered for you here. Thank you very much.
And I've actually kicked another question over to Jesse already, but if you have any questions for Jesse about technical things, online security, Bitcoin nodes, stuff like that, using Start9, because Jesse's pretty switched on with that, anything like that, send them in to jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com, TSPC in the subject line, and with expert panel stuff, TSP experts even better, because then I know right away it's for this. Tell me the expert you want to ask a question of, then give me the question in one sentence. I promise you can do it. Hit return a couple times, and then give me any details you feel are relevant. You can give me as much detail as you want. Just give me the entire question for the right expert in one line, and tell me who that expert is. Please do me one favor, guys. Do not send me an email with 10 questions for 10 people in it. It makes my life really hard. And if I just forward it, it causes confusion. It's not good. You know, if you do two, that's okay. Really, the best practice is send me an email per question. That makes my life easy. And when my life's easy, I do a better job for you. I'm just going to be honest about it. With that, let's move on now. We got a question here for Joel Riles on doguses. Specifically, how we get the dog to understand that this command I'm giving dog A does not apply to dog B right now, and that can be an issue. And let's go ahead and hear what Joel has to say on it.
Hello, everyone. This is Joel with Fortress K9 and K9 Academy, coming back at you today with another listener question. And today's question comes from Kenneth, and he's asking about training two dogs to be able to respond to different commands. So he said basically whenever he gives his commands, both dogs are responding to the same command. So I'm assuming this is, you know, you tell your dogs to lay down plets, and they both lay down, but I only wanted one dog to lay down. So let me take one step back to start answering this question and assume that you're starting two dogs. You're trying to get obedience in two dogs, and you want them to be able to respond to individual commands. So the very first thing you need to do is you need to make sure that the dogs understand the commands. Now, one common mistake people will make is they will try to train both dogs at the same time. You certainly can do this. But when you're just starting with working two dogs, it can often be a lot easier if you'll work them one at a time. So what I'll often do is I'll bring both dogs out, but I'll just tether one in a shady spot, and they're nearby, so they're kind of observing and they can see what we're doing, but they're not the one being worked at that moment, right? And then I'll focus on one dog. And the reason I want to work with one at a time is I want to make sure before I start trying to separate the commands out between the dogs is that each dog knows what the commands mean. So I want to make sure that my dog knows what seats, which is to sit. I want them to know that seats means sit. And I want them to know that plets means lay down or whatever commands you're using. But I want to make sure that the commands I'm trying to give to the dogs, each dog understands what those are, and they're relatively good at obeying those commands first. So I'll typically start them one at a time until I know that each dog understands what the commands are. Then what I do is I want to be close to both dogs as I'm working. I like to put dogs up on tables. I have these heavy-duty wooden tables that we've built so that I'm not leaning over and stuff like that. You don't have to have tables, but it definitely makes it easier if you have something that the dogs can be up on so that you're not leaning over and things like that. Then I'm going to have a lead on both dogs. And whatever methodology you're using, I want to be close and I want to have access to the corrections, but I also want to be able to quickly adjust the dogs and then praise the dogs when they're doing what I want. So typically what I'll do is I'll put both dogs up on a table and I'll tell them both to lay down beside each other. And I want to make sure they're not overly distracted by each other. So when you first start to do this, you may just have to spend a little bit of time getting the dogs to calm down being right beside one another, right? This is especially true when I'm working puppies. I work the puppies individually, and then when I put two puppies on the same table, they're all excited, and they want to play with each other, and they're like, oh, hey, how you doing? And I go, no, leave that alone, plutz, and I'll put them down in a plutz, and I'll get them to where they will just calmly lay beside one another, and they're not constantly trying to interact, right? And then once I have them where they understand leave it, and they're not going to try and interact with each other, I use their names, and so let's say we have Chaos and Dagger, right, on the table, and I'll go Chaos, seats, and now if he sits on his own and then Dagger sits alongside him, I'll grab the lead for Dagger and I'll say, no, Dagger, plutz, but then at the same time I'm holding the lead up on Chaos, the first dog. I'm not holding tension in the lead. I just have the lead in my hand so that if he starts to lay back down, I can bump him up and I go, Chaos, good seats, Dagger, good plutz. Chaos, good seats, Dagger, good plutz. And I'll kind of pet them. If, you know, the first dog wants to lay back down, no, fooey that, seats, good seats, good plutz, good seats, good plutz. But I'm right there beside them so that if either dog moves from the position I want them to be in, I can very quickly, almost instantly, because I've got the leads in my hands, literally they're at arm's reach from me, and I can just correct them and put them into the positions I want them in, praise them individually, back and forth, for being in that position, and then I'll switch them up. So Chaos plutz, good plutz, Chaos, Dagger seats. And then if Chaos tries to seats, I bump him down with the lead. No, you plutz, you seats, good seats, right? And I'll go back and forth, or I'll put, you know, one in a seats, and then I'll tell the other one to sit beside him, and then I'll put one in a plutz, and I'll tell the other one to plutz beside him. And I will work them, and here's what we don't want to do when we're doing these types of drills, is we don't want to become overly, we don't want to develop a pattern. Right? So we don't want always one dog to do it, then the other dog does it, and it's in this like constant back and forth, because then they just think that we're following the pattern. Right? So I'll have one dog sit, and then the other dog sit, and then I might have, you know, dog number two lay down, and dog number two sit, and dog number two lay down, and dog number two sit, and then dog number one lay down and sit. And I mix it up so that I'm not just setting a pattern that the dogs are doing. But pretty quickly, what you'll get is the dogs will start understanding when my name is said, then he's talking to me. If my name is not said, he's not talking to me. Now, if your dogs don't know their names yet, that's going to be what the learning part in their brain is, oh, I'm Chaos. Oh, I'm Dagger. And I don't do a thing unless he says, Chaos, do this thing. And I don't do a thing unless he says, Dagger, do a thing. And so we've got a trash truck coming up there. Sorry about that ambient noise. But basically, we want the dogs to understand their names, and then we want them to understand, if I say your name and I tell you to do a thing, you do it. Now, here's the other thing I add into that. Because I don't want... Sorry about that distraction. Because I don't want, say, Dagger to sit, and I do want Chaos to sit, I may go, Dagger, wait. Good wait. Pet him on the head. Chaos seats. Good seats. Now, if Dagger sits... he's violating the wait command that I just gave him, right? So then I can correct him, say, fooey that, plutz, praise him, good plutz, you wait, Chaos seats. Okay? So you've got to get comfortable using their names prior to a command. And then when you screw it up and you just maybe walk out and say seats and they both sit together, well, I didn't specify which dog, so that's okay. But if I specify a dog, then that dog is to do the command. And I usually preempt that by telling the dog that I know I am not going to want to move to wait. Dagger, wait. Chaos, seats. Good seats. Chaos, wait. Dagger, seats. Good seats. And that way, each dog is learning. I only respond when my name is said and then the command is given. One other thing I'll put into this is do not make their name a command. This is most common, this error occurs most commonly when you're doing recalls, right? So let's say you have both dogs out, now you've got them to respond to their names individually, but they're out, say, 10, 15 feet away, and you're calling them to you. And you say, Chaos, and he knows, oh, I'm about to get called, and upon hearing his name, he jumps up and runs to you. You've got to correct that. Buoy that, go back to your place. Saying your name is like the preparatory command in a drill and ceremony, right? So they'll say, right face. But you only turn when they say face. The right is letting you know which direction you're about to turn so you can prepare for it. But you're not actually doing it until you hear the command of execution. So Chaos, saying their name, is the preparation. Hey, I'm about to tell you something. Listen. So when I'm doing recalls, it's Chaos. Good weight. Chaos. Let's go. Go, 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 go. Now, if Dagger breaks in that situation, I'm going to praise Chaos for doing what he's supposed to do, and I'm going to ignore the dog that broke for just a second because I want this dog to get his praise. Then I'm going to put him in and say a down, and then I grab the dog that broke that wasn't supposed to. I give them a little correction, and I take them back and put them back in their place. Again, when I start that, I'm only taking one or two steps back so that my resetting the exercise only takes two steps back in the direction to put them where they're supposed to be, and I'm not walking 30, 50 feet to reset the dogs. And so get them used to their names, make sure that they understand the commands, and then start them close until it starts to click in their dog brain that they're supposed to only do a command when they hear their name, or if there's no name given, then they can all obey the same command. I hope that helps. I'm looking forward to getting more questions from you guys. Remember, if you want more information about training dogs, you can always check out canineacademy.us. I highly recommend you go over to Jack's website, thesurvivalpodcast.com. Click on the banner there so that he gets credit for this since he's sending me these questions. And I love it when you guys support him. If you're interested in getting a trained dog, check out fortresscanine.com. And if you let me know that you heard about us on Jack's podcast, we have a discount we'll hook you guys up with if you're looking at getting a puppy or a trained dog. All right, until next time, guys, remember to train hard and stay safe.
All right, good stuff from Joel. And remember, if you want to learn how to train your canine, canineacademy.us is a place to do it. If you'd use the banner on the website, that I would appreciate that because my agreement with Joel is an affiliate agreement. But he does a great job of training, and you have a free course you can take from there. It's called the Problem Solving Library, and it gives you an understanding of what it's going to be like to take courses from Canine Academy. Next up, I got a segment for you from Nicole Sauce, and this is going to be a follow-up to the question that I, Nick, and Ben Falk answered last week. A gentleman moving to a new homestead's got no infrastructure in place and wants to know where to get started. So let's hear from Nicole on that.
Well, hello, TSP. Nicole Sauce here from the Living Free in Tennessee podcast and Hollow Roast Coffee with a question from Michael about what to build first when moving out of the city and into the urban rural fringe with some property. Because, well, it looks like Michael's feeling a little bit of pressure about what's going to happen in the next few years and wants more self-resilience or self-reliance for his family. And this question's already been answered by three other people, but I think I have a little bit of a different take on it. So I'm going to answer the question. And the first thing I want to know is a question back, which is, what is driving your urgency? Is it excitement or fear? I think it's an awesome goal to want to have more resilience, durability, and self-reliance in your life. But if your primary driver is fear, that can mean that you make poor decisions, or you make decisions that help you short term, but not long term. And sometimes they even undermine you short term if you do them the wrong way. So first thing I'd say is slow your roll, evaluate your why, and find a way to make it positive for your life moving forward. And that means having some talks with your family about how you and they want to set up your new property in a way that empowers you not only for whatever happens after this fall or after the fall or even after the next 4 years or whatever it is. How do you want it and why do you want it that way for the long term? Find that place of excitement and hope if you're not already there. And you might already be there because you found this great property, but I just wanted to say that to start with. Also, take initial steps that are flexible. Getting ready for fall and spring which are only a few months away, really, with a lot of permanence, can make a lot more work in the future if what you put in is not done from a top sort of big picture, what we want for this property standpoint. And everything you've mentioned that you already have are things that can be set up to be very movable. So I'm talking like a chicken tractor for your chicken, things like that, so that when you know more about what your property is after you've gotten there and had a chance to interface with it, you can set things up the way they need to be rather than say, well, I guess I put the chicken coop way too far away from the house or unfortunately too close to the house. Either one of those is possible. And now it's right where I want to, you know, do X. And now I've got to pull down this whole building. I would spend time defining what you mean with your family, creating the big picture goals for the property, and also get feedback from the land when you get there. If you're in more of a hurry, though, bringing in an outside consultant is a huge idea. So once you know your goals for the property, how it relates to your family, how much time you really think you're going to put in, those sorts of things, and the kinds of things that you mean when you say more self-reliance, bringing in an outside consultant gives a fresh set of eyes that are separate from any emotional attachment you have to anything on the property. And they, with your goals, can give you a really good plan fairly quickly. We have a couple of great consultants in Tennessee that do that here, and they specialize in small properties. I am certain you have it there, and I would hop on to any of the TSP forums and just see if anybody does that kind of consulting in your area. Of course, if you can get one of our guys or Nick Ferguson or anybody out there on one of their times through, that's a great thing too. The key here though is have a really good idea of what you want from the property before bringing that consultant in. And then if you're in more of a hurry and have money to be more in a hurry, bring two consultants in and compare the two plans. I've found having more than one consultant when my goals are clear and comparing the plans really helps me solidify the things that are best to start with, because usually, well, actually, I've had four permaculturists out to my property, and all of their plans have either complemented each other or overlapped a lot. And I think that's because once you have those goals, they can give you a lot of good advice. And while doing all of this, so I've said slow your roll, right? So while doing over all of this and, you know, spending that time figuring it out and having people out and that sort of thing, you can still make forward progress. And here's some thoughts I have on that. First of all, I'm making the assumption that you already know you like chickens. And since you already have them, you might as well have chickens, right? I'm also assuming you have a use for a kitchen garden, and that there is no HOA that's going to be up your butt about how you do things. And then also that you're willing to raise livestock for meat. When I think about self-reliance, I think about the need for community. And the term we've been bantering about in the last few months is community reliance. It means that you're connected with the people in your local community as well as other people in your digital community, and you can trust one another, and you can trade for resources and, you know, human resources, like helping each other with projects as well as actual things you need. For me, when I think about self-reliance, I also think about cover basic needs, food, water, medical, and your land. The easiest thing to get off of it is the food and the medical, right? So hopefully water as well. So food security goal one that you can work on that will not undermine anything you're doing in the future is identify and build great relationships, close relationships, meaningful relationships with people from your community from whom you can buy food and other supplies, like maybe somebody makes lumber or you have somebody who's a metal worker or a welder, that sort of thing. A great way to do that is start going out to things in your community where you meet that kind of person or the right kind of person, like your farmer's market, or if there's some sort of a, you know, farm-based festival that happens in the area, a maker's space. You never know where you'll find these people. And also definitely get to know your neighbors because they may already be connected in those ways. Food security goal two, source food in times of abundance and then do that in a, like preserve it in a way that makes sense to you. So by which I mean, if somebody has way too many green beans right now, then buy them, see if they'll give you a deal, and if not, just buy them, spend the money on it, and then go home and can them, dry them, freeze dry them, freeze them, however you want to preserve those things. Likewise for your local chicken producer or your cow producer, like all of those things you can get done right now, and right now is when abundance comes on. Right now is when like corn prices dropped, we have tomato palooza in Tennessee right now, all of those things are happening, and your local producers are super happy to provide you with stuff that you can preserve for the future. And that helps with goal one, which is trying to develop a better relationship with, you know, like stronger relationships with people in your community. Food security goal three, make compost. All the compost. If you're going to have a kitchen garden, you're going to want compost. If you're going to want to put in a food forest, you're going to want compost. If you want to put in a fodder system, you're going to want compost. Jack has, incidentally, a really cool course on compost. So take that. That's something you can spend time in. You'll learn some great stuff, and it'll inspire you to make compost. And you can seek biological waste to help you with this. What do I mean by that? I do not mean medical waste. I mean things that restaurants aren't using, extra waste from farmers who don't compost it back, your neighbor's food scraps, wood chips, any of those things. That can all be stuff you gather both from your property and your community to start you on your journey towards making lots of compost. And if you have chickens, check out the chicken tractor on steroids method for raising them, because it makes compost. And you have chickens, and you can have more chickens, and you know how to deal with chickens. And a chicken tractor is temporary and movable. All of those things. It fits the bill. And you get compost and eggs and sometimes meat. The idea here is use what you already know to set yourself up for success in some basic areas in a way that you can adjust it as you build out your property and interface with your local community, because those relationships are the durability more than anything you do on your property. And, you know, this has really hit me this year because I've been away a lot and my garden is not as automated as it would need to be for me to be away a lot. So I've had some crop failures. My biggest crop failure is the thing that we eat the most in the winter, which are green beans. And I've just like, I've had enough come off the garden to use, but not to can. And so I've been going to my farmer's market every week when I'm in town for years. Before I was selling there. I have great relationships with those guys. So I just went around and said, hey guys, my green beans failed. And so if anybody has extra green beans for sale, like that you're not selling here, just let me know. I have sourced 3 bushels of green beans this week from one of the local farmers in a year where green beans haven't done as well here as they usually do. And what that means is I can spend money, they're happy, they get my money, I get the green beans, and I get it done. And if I had not spent the last couple of decades developing those relationships, it would have been a lot harder for me to find the green beans, because the person I found it from is not selling at the farmer's market. It's just somebody I know who used to sell. And he's like, man, I was about to feed those to my pigs. And I'm like, feed them to me, man. Feed them to me. So there you go. If you're solid on your goals and have a plan for your property by, say, September, October, you may find that you have plans that you're firm about for an orchard or a food fodder system, or both of those things work together, and you can get that done, because like bare root planting is awesome, and it's a great way to do it without spending a lot of money, and you get it all in and it has all winter long to develop its roots, and the timing for this is actually pretty perfect for you. And then you can spend the winter getting ready for whichever livestock you think you're going to want to add to the property, putting in fencing, shelters, those sorts of things. Also, get the inside of your home nailed to support the new kind of lifestyle you want to live, with storage, your kitchen is set up for food preservation if that's in your plan, backup heat, if you don't have a wood stove, those sorts of things, or I'm assuming you're in a place that needs heat in the winter when I say that. Cooling, if that's the other thing. The sooner you do this, the smoother everything is when you're really focused outside and you have all winter to get this done. It's actually one of my biggest regrets that I didn't get my house set up for me before I started going full Monty on the homestead. And now that my house is way better set up, it's so much easier. So I'm just throwing that one out there. It's the thing we tend to disregard because we're like, I need to produce food now. And you're like, wow, I would have spent so much less time dealing with all the stuff I was producing if I would have just had my permaculture design inside my house to begin with. So other fast food ideas for you is, in fact, rabbits, which are not hard to raise at all, quail, raised beds near the house. Like, you could have a raised bed that you start now that you get ready for fall planting near your house, and that's just a little bit of food production. And you could also have long-term herbs and other stuff, like right by your kitchen door, for example. Water catchment and storage is easy because plants and animals need water, and so do humans. Firewood cooks food and it gives you heat, and you can start stacking that. And then something I just stumbled across that you might want to just look at but don't commit to doing, but check it out. Korean Natural Gardening has a method for raising pigs smell-free that's pretty awesome, and I've seen it in progress now. And had I known about that, I might have actually kept smaller but pigs on my property long-term in a small space. It's designed to work in a small space, so I don't know if you eat pork, but I'm sure you're going to go down that path of livestock as well. And they both compost your stuff and produce meat if you're going to do that. You know, like your food scraps is what they compost. So those are my thoughts about how I would approach this. It does start with slow your roll, step back, make your plan, decide if you need to have consultants in. Anything you do immediately, make sure it's movable, movable fencing, movable shelters for animals. And then make all the compost you can and get ready to start implementing towards the winter. Hope this helps you. Guys, if you want to build more skills and meet great people, wherever you are, we're having a stellar event in Camden, Tennessee at Special Operations Equipment. It's called Self-Reliance Festival. Jack is speaking along with a bunch of other great people. And early bird tickets are on sale through the end of the day Thursday. That's today when the show comes out. I've decided that since you guys are awesome, I'm going to give you a coupon code that will start working after early bird tickets go up. And if you want to grab your ticket to the Self-Reliance Festival, use coupon code TSP, and it will get you that same early bird price through the end of the day Sunday. Make it a great week.
All right, so I want to answer a question for Christina here, and it'll be a shorter answer than usual because it's pretty simple. I'm going to read her question first so you know where I'm coming from. On your recent episode, The Dollar is Dying, you spoke about doing Uber and DoorDash, etc. You said you wouldn't make much money on paper, but after deductions and taxes, there were advantages to doing it. I didn't quite follow that. Could you elaborate on a bit? I've been considering doing a part-time contract job that pays $18 an hour, but I have to pay my own taxes. I have to drive to various locations. Travel time is included in the pay. I know there are vehicle and mileage deductions, but I'm unclear about the other advantages. Thanks, Christina. Okay, so this has an awful lot to do with what is really going on here. First of all, my spider sense is tingling and telling me this is a job where they are going to treat you like an employee but call you a contractor. If they give you like orders of when you have to be, where you have to be, and how you have to do, other than standard procedures and stuff like that, basically they're circumventing the law here and they don't want to pay benefits and they're calling it as a contract job, but they're going to treat you like an employee. If that's the case, I'm not saying not to take the job. I think people should be able to pay people however they want, and people should work based on their desire to work and who they want to work for and the compensation they're going to get. So I don't care that that's what they're doing, but I feel like that might be what they're doing. And that may give you some additional leverage, and this is something you can only determine for yourself about. Maybe you want some different terms, and those terms may play into some other things I'm about to tell you. First of all, the thing about Uber and DoorDash and what have you is with those services, the minute you turn the app on, wherever you are, when somebody summons you or you get an order like if it's for Amazon delivery or something, and you're heading to get it, that mileage is all 100% deductible all the way until the last person or the last thing you deliver. And then when you're going home, it's not deductible. If you have a job like this and they say you're going to work in city, town A, one, or just say locations, because it might not even be different towns. It could be a big city in different parts. You're going to go location A on Monday and Tuesday, location B on Thursday, and location C on Friday. And your travel is going to be nothing but from your house to that location and home, you have exactly 0 mileage you can deduct. If it's you're going to go work at location A in the morning, B in the afternoon, and then go home, the only mileage that you, by following the code as written, you will be able to deduct is from location A to location B. You do not get to knock off mileage going home unless it's like a specific business travel. So like if you're driving four states over to go do an event, you can deduct all that. But a routine commute, the IRS says that's just like somebody with a job until you're actually using your vehicle for your contract, for your business, right? Because you're doing something an employee would not be doing, right? Then you can do the deduction. That's the way that I've always understood the deduction. Again, I'm telling you to talk to a CPA. There are some things that you could do to change that. And one is, if you go to an office every day, the mileage from that office, all the shit you do, and when you come back to it, is deductible. And then the mileage from the office back to your home or from your home to the office in the morning is not. That I'm sure of. Well, what if you had an office? Well, Jack, you know, I'm not going to make enough money to make it worth getting an office. What if you had a free office? And you got to be careful on this, and I would run this by a CPA. But, I mean, for instance, I just saw this advertisement for Comerica Bank, and they have Comerica Workspaces. Basically, it's like inside their banks, they have these places with, like, offices and meeting areas and conference rooms and desks. And in the commercial, what's happened is a dude's trying to do a Zoom meeting from home, and the kid's screaming and everything else, and he can't get it done, so he could be going to the Comerica Workspace. Well, I don't know what their policies are, but if you have something like that available to you and you went there every day, briefly, for whatever reason, to do paperwork or whatever, to me, I would go buy a CPA on this, but I don't see how that wouldn't be considered now your office space. You know, I'm just saying. And you also have to look at what are the... Now, see, I don't know anything about the job you're doing here. So you have to look at what are all the things that you can move over into a deduction column. Or what things could you call expenses for work? And again, this is a CPA conversation. My gut is not a lot. My gut is that the majority of what I said about the way you can rape the tax code driving for Uber or DoorDash or something like that, or Uber Eats, is probably not true here. It's probably not. Now, you have to decide what you want to do and what you don't want to do. You might make a hell of a lot more money and keep a hell of a lot more money driving for DoorDash or Uber than doing this side contract work. It has to do with, you know, what is the work? Will you enjoy it? You know, and what have you, and then what's going to be left in the pay. But this is the way you have to look at your paycheck that you're going to be getting from a contract job like this. Whatever you pay in Social Security on a W-2 job, double it. That's what you're going to pay. You're going to pay your own matching. So it's not just about... See, you always paid your own taxes. You just don't see it. And the only real tax penalty you're going to get here is that doubling of Social Security. And so what you need to do to make this work, no matter how you do it, is prepayments so that you do not end up in a hole with your tax return. So you need to figure out how much money you would have withheld from you if this was a W-2 job. Withhold it from yourself and quarterly make payments to the IRS. So the way we do that is real simple. We just have all the business money, and you could emulate this. Most banks do not charge you for additional accounts. You can set them up online in minutes. So we have a checking account, and that checking account handles business expenses, and it receives all the money that's collected through various merchant accounts. Some people pay Visa, MasterCard, etc., and through Stripe or through PayPal or something like that, one of our merchant accounts. So that will accumulate. They'll pay us into our bank account. We'll request a withdrawal every week, and it'll go in that account. And again, we will pay bills out of that account for the business as well. And then we will say, of that amount of money, here's our paycheck this week. You know, 70% of the money is money we get for us. And we will then transfer that into some, it could be a savings, our primary checking, could be split, depends on what we need. And we leave that money behind. every quarter, whatever in that account, we send that to the government as a prepayment to the IRS. And my accountant gets on me every year because we get big returns. And I told her, well, 1 year I didn't do that, and I wrote a $6,800 check to the IRS with money I didn't have, and I will never do that again. And that was 20 years ago, and you were here when I did it, and you should remember. Okay? So that's kind of the approach there. I don't know that this will really help you, but the idea itself, to make no money on paper, to make very little money on paper, doesn't mean, and I got the feeling that Christine got the idea that meant that you didn't actually profit very much, that maybe you could lose enough money that by losing that money you kept more of other money, other income, because your tax bracket was reduced or something. That's not what I'm saying at all. What I'm saying is, Uber driver goes out this week, he makes $500. His hard, real expenses that he paid, let's say, were $150. Let's say he drove Friday and Saturday. So he made $500 of money in. That's other than cash tips, where somebody, like people like me, tend to like turn to their Uber driver and say, don't worry about the fact you're going to get jack shit of a tip on the app. Here's $25. That never happened. Wink. Right? Because I want them to maximize this as much as possible. But they made $500 that came in recorded. They have $150 in gas and actual real wear and tear on their vehicle that they can quantify in some way in their head. That's really what it cost them. So their profit is, what, $350. But the mileage deduction, I'd have to look it up to be willing to bet on it. I want to say it's like 65, 67, something. It's in the 60s. It's high, mid to high 60 cents an hour. So it's very possible that to make that money, that they may have taken $300 in mileage deductions, right? Or $400. Let's say $400 in mileage deductions. They're now going to pay tax on $100. But they put $350 in their pocket. If they're paying a 20% tax rate, you know, cut it in half, and now they're paying like 6% tax on that income. Effective tax rate, not true tax rate, you see? Because tax is on income, tax is not on revenue. And this is a place that people have a really hard time making the mental adjustment and understanding the advantages of running a business and moving as many things into the expense column as possible. It doesn't matter how much money you take in. It matters how much of that money is subject to income tax based on the tax code and you filing appropriately within the confines of the tax code. And what I mean by that is the government has no problem with you taking every deduction that the tax code says you're entitled to. You can get audited. It's very unlikely at the income level most people asking these questions. Like the people that get audited the most, I know they told you it's people that make less than $30,000 a year, and that's what they sent all these 80,000 new IRS. No. Bullshit. Okay? Bullshit. And then some more bullshit. Like a little kid, a little baby kid in the car seat. He's like, a bullshit. Those are not audits. Those are letters of demand. We believe that you underpaid by $100 and now you owe us $300 because of interest and penalties. Please give us money. And you either send them money or you send them a letter telling them they're wrong. That's not an audit. Audits are not fun. Audits are like having a colonoscopy by a giant with no anesthetic, and he's using his arm for the colonoscopy. It is horrible. And it's people that have businesses with a turnover of $2 to $6 million are the primary targets. That's the primary targets. You know why? They have enough money to be worth going after, and they don't have enough money to have an army of attorneys. Businesses with $100 million in revenue, go ahead and audit them if you want to, and they do it occasionally. They do it occasionally, but they're like, well, here's our 17 primary attorneys. They'll talk to you, and we'll see if we need to send in our reserve attorneys. So they don't like that. They like mom-and-pop businesses with enough financial turnover to get a good hit, and they like sending letters of demand to people who would just pay the bill because they're afraid. They also like sending letters of demand to people who don't have enough money to pay the bill, who will pay part of the bill and end up strung along for years trying to catch back up. They love that. So I wouldn't worry about getting audited. I would worry about being right. And so definitely talk to your CPA. And Christine, if you want to send me a little more information about what this business is, what it entails, how many days of work you would week, what your travel actually looks like. Because again, if you're home, one location home, there's no deduction at all there, unless you can find a way to structure things differently. All right, with that, let's go ahead and wrap up. Let me remind you again, if you like the show and the work that we do, you can help us out by doing your online shopping beginning at tspaz.com. It's easy to remember, tspaz.com, T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. Go there and you can find all of our reviews. Check out these stainless steel work tables and carts from Vavor. They're awesome. And also check out the electric sausage press that I reviewed this week for you with the how-to video on making some really awesome sausage. I'm going to have some more video coming over the weekend. Probably by Monday it'll be dropped on making another batch of sausage. This one's going to be brisket and jalapeno sausage, and that should be badass. I've already got it all cut up, seasoning on it, cubed up, and in the refrigerator. It'll get ground sometime today. That's when the jalapenos will get incorporated into it, and we will get it smoked up. And if that one comes out the way I think it is, it will absolutely 100% be featured at the fall workshop in November of this year. Again, that workshop, people keep asking, it will be the week of the 13th, but it will begin, I think, on the 17th or something like that, the 13th or the 11th, the week of the 11th. Let me get this for you. I'm about to screw it up. Okay, fall workshop this year will be November 13th reception day. That's when people just show up, get their camping gear set up and all that if they're camping, or just hang out and then go to their hotel if they're going to hotel it. We eat sausages and we talk and we drink beers, and it's like welcome, and it's also for a lot of people that come a lot of times like a reunion. Then we have the actual workshop dates are Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and those will be the 14th, 15th, and 16th. We let people stay over the night of the 16th if they're staying on site, and we send you packing by lunchtime-ish on the 17th, which is Sunday. So it will be the 13th through the 17th this year. It is the week of the 11th. The 11th just lands on a Monday. You're like, it's further out than normal. It is. That's how it worked out. The week before, that's election week. We don't want to do that. And the week after that is right up stacked against Thanksgiving, so we don't want to do that. And we want it as far out as we can get it so we have enough time to get ready as possible. So we will be serving that sausage and some other of my personally made sausages this year. And we're going to have some really cool stuff going on. We got that margarita machine going to be going on and on fajita night, and it's going to be a great event. Tickets will go on sale probably about the second or third week of September like they always do. And once I announce the date, mark your calendar and be ready to go, because last year it sold out in 2 minutes flat. So definitely check out that product. It's pretty cool. And remember, if you shop at tspaz.com, whenever you shop online, you'll help us out. With that, I'll catch you tomorrow with that Friday flashback. They said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month. You never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way. You don't have to be another face in the crowd. You don't have to live the way they tell you. Revolution.